Hi, you're listening to the weekly podcast of Life Ministry Church. For more information, head to our website, www.lmc.org.au.
So that's a pretty confronting little podcast, isn't it? And something that gives us some understanding. The words that stood out for me, as I've heard, and I've heard it three or four times, adult agenda, indoctrination and grooming. Can you just talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's very difficult for us to understand coming into this is, why would anyone want to do that to a child? Because we assume that people are reasonable and that they want the best for children, and that parents especially would do anything for the benefit of their children. There's no way that you'd want to lead a child down a path like that if it wasn't for their best, if it wasn't for compassionate reasons. And on the other hand, there are a lot of adults and a lot of people in the LGBT movement don't have children themselves, don't understand what children are like, don't understand natural curiosity. And a lot of them, as we saw earlier, if you were here, you would have seen Dr. Elizabeth Riley. Well, she was a social worker with very good intentions, I'm sure, working with adult transgender people, who said that I always had this internal sense that I was the opposite gender. I always knew. So she thought, well, where are the transgender kids? And let's go and help them. So I'm sure she did it with good motives. But whether or not that's the right thing is, Walt Heyer would say, absolutely not. That's a terrible thing to do to a child. In fact, what you're doing is confirming something that probably will disappear on its own. And if it's there, then they need help to get over it. I had an elderly gentleman come up to me after I was speaking in Perth, and he said, when I was little, I thought I was a horse. And I had a lot of fun pretending I was a horse, and I would pretend to eat hay, and I'd gallop around, and I'd neigh, and I'd dress up as a horse. And I was enjoying this sort of fantasy of being a horse. But if the whole adult world had suddenly agreed with me that I was a horse, well, that really would have scared me. Because all of the adults in your world can't be lying to you, can they? So you trust adults to guide you in what is true and what is real, what is solid. And if they all suddenly agree that your fantasy is true, well, then you would, instead of thinking that they've all gone mad, you would begin to think, oh, I must be wrong. They must be right. Of course, that's how you would. So that's where you groom children into believing that this fantasy is real.
Last year, I was in Melbourne here, and I heard you talk, and I can't remember the doctor's name.
It's John Whitehall.
John Whitehall. One of the things that stood out when he was talking was that by doing the hormone treatment, et cetera, we're slowing down the process of the body developing, which, if left to themselves, they would normally grow out of their thought patterns. Can you just unpack that just a tad?
Yes, so they don't know exactly why this is, but it's something to do with the process, the flow of the cascade of hormones in puberty. There's a part of the pituitary gland that suddenly kicks in. Now, there's a lot of medical science around this that they don't know. They believe now that this is part of the brain that's formed in very early fetal development, and it's like a preparation. It's a switch that's there, and it's just waiting to be turned on by puberty. And so the cascade of hormones is what develops the secondary sex characteristics of boys and girls. And until that time, the bodies of boys and girls are not materially very different, but it's this cascade of hormones that changes them. So as far as the transgender people are concerned, puberty can be very distressing. If you think you're a boy and you suddenly grow breasts, well, that's difficult to get over. I think puberty can be a very confronting time for teenagers anyway, because your body's changing in all sorts of ways and you haven't got any control over it. And so the prevailing wisdom from the LGBT lobby is to say, well, we want to prevent children having the distress of going through puberty in the wrong body. And also, if they've been through puberty and they've developed secondary sex characteristics, you know, for example, if boys have grown very broad shoulders and they're now 6'3", well, it's going to be harder as an adult to pass as a woman. So what we're going to do is we're going to suspend puberty. And they use something called puberty blockers. Puberty blockers had a very narrow, specific use in medicine for certain types of illness, where puberty started too early, and various other hormonal complications. But they realised that they could use it to suspend puberty. And what the doctors will tell you is, this is safe and entirely reversible. Safe and entirely reversible, safe and entirely reversible. This sort of mantra until we all glaze over and believe that it's safe and entirely reversible. The problem is, according to John Whitehall's information, he's a paediatrician, is that it hasn't been tested. And the idea that puberty, if you just... The idea is that if you just stop the puberty blockers, that then puberty will kick in. But they're now realising that puberty at the age of 18 is quite different to puberty at the age of 12. So there are untested and unknown physiological responses that we really don't know very much about. The idea that you're not actually reversing something anyway, you're just allowing something to happen that would have happened normally. Anyway, all of that aside, there are issues with the puberty blockers. There are other issues with the puberty blockers, which is that it blocks other parts of the brain that they didn't know about. They tested, does it stop puberty? Yes, it does. It also inhibits all sorts of other receptors to the brain. So one of the things that they think it does is that it upsets emotions and it interferes with the part of the brain, the limbic system, which is in charge of rational thought, processing emotions, all of these things that you would really need to do if you're a transgender kid trying to work it out. But the wisdom behind stopping puberty is because that way the child doesn't have the secondary sex characteristics, but also we're going to give them time to think about the future of whether or not they would like to have children. Because the next stage after puberty blockers is to then have cross-sex hormones. Cross-sex hormones, again, were used for the treatment of very specific illnesses. They have not been tested on humans. This is extraordinary. This is incredible that this is happening. But it hasn't been tested on humans in large population groups and not for this long period of time. What they have done is they've tested the cross-sex hormones on sheep. There's a group in Scotland and another one in Oslo that have been testing these hormones on sheep. And the results are that the sheep become very nervous. How do you tell if a sheep is nervous? This is what John Whitehall was telling us about anyway. So they would have these sheep and they'd run them through a maze and the sheep would get to know the maze very well until they could do it very quickly. And then they would start treating them with cross-sex hormones and the sheep would become very nervous. Well, how do you tell if a sheep is nervous? You measure how much it wheeze and poos as it goes through the maze. And they found that they were very nervous and highly strung and that their ability to navigate through the maze significantly slowed their process. So it was interfering with their brains. At the end of this 6 months, they examined the sheep's brains and found changes, and the changes are different depending on whether you're male to female or female to male. But in either case, it's doing something to your brain that it's not supposed to do. And the rate of aging of the brain was 10 times what would happen normally. So none of this has been tested. And when we do scientific experiments, typically you would have a control group and you would measure the results. But we're not even doing that. We're just giving them willy-nilly to the population. If you look at the science behind the use of cross-sex hormones, it's not very sound. The transgender movement have started, and this is why I was recommending going to see Van Meter, Dr. Van Meter, who's coming in August, because he will tell you all of how this got pushed through under the guise of proper medicine. So they've got their own international standards, they've got their own standards of care, they've got an international journal of transgender medicine, but the sorts of research that get published in there are very limited and only one-sided, and they won't allow any critical voice. There was a really good publication recently, 2016, by Paul McHugh and Lawrence Mayer. Now, Paul McHugh was the chief psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in the 1970s. So John Money had started sex change surgeries and he'd done quite a number. And Paul McHugh was concerned that a number of them were suiciding afterwards. So he commissioned an independent review of the process. And the independent review concluded that sex change surgery, at the very best, was not helping people. Their life outcomes were no better having been through this process. So on the basis of that, Paul McHugh closed the sex change surgery down. There's no one as well qualified to speak on this as he is in the world. He just said it's bad medicine. This is a psychological illness. We cannot treat it by changing the body. So he wrote recently an article on gender and sexuality. Well, the International Journal for Transgender Medicine wasn't going to publish that, were they? So they had to publish it separately. So and in fact, he was protested. Johns Hopkins University was threatened with having its inclusivity rating reduced just for publishing this, properly academic research. So they've really put a lot of pressure on shutting down any voices that say this isn't the right way to go. But the indications are that we're mucking up a lot of bodies in the process, irreversibly, And it also leads to sterility as well. So a lot of these people won't be able to have children.
Okay, so what we're going to do, we're going to ask some questions now and open it up to the floor. If you do have a question, what I'd like you to do is just raise your hand. Andy or Sky will come to you. And again, please ask the question. Don't tell us your thoughts. Ask the question. And again, we're here to be nice. So let's make certain we keep them safe and tame, hey? So, Ken, thanks.
Thanks. You talked about shutting down criticism. It's not the first battle, freedom of speech. And where is it now and where do you see it going?
Well, that depends on whether the Australian health practitioners are allowed to change their regulation for medical conduct. I'm pretty stunned at how quickly doctors accept this stuff, because this is based on post-structuralist philosophy. It's not based on science. But they, I have a friend, it's been quite useful actually, she works for Headspace and she treats transgender people. She's not a Christian, but she went along to the, you know, gender's not quite as simple as you think workshop. And I think she just would have accepted it all as a matter of course, except that I'd been sending her John Whitehall's articles. So she had me in her other ear while this was going on. And she'd been saying, look, we just want to help these children. We just want to do what's best for them. And maybe giving them hormones is the best thing as part of their therapy to get them back to their natal sex. And I said, so you think gender congruence is an ideal outcome for them? And she said, yes, absolutely. And I said, well, that makes you a transphobe, according to this political agenda. So in terms of where it's going, that's a political answer. It really depends on whether or not these people... I think eventually it will implode just under the weight of its own absurdity. But how many people it takes with it is the question. So that's really up to us and how forcefully we respond. I don't think... If we leave it to itself, it will take a lot longer, put it that way.
Mm. So Ken,
where it's going is parents' rights, as you saw, stopping anybody who could ever stop a child wandering down, including Walt Heyer was saying in Chile now it's illegal to reverse back. You can change your gender one way, but they won't recognise it if you want to go the other way. So they're really concerned with sticking people into a queer identity and keeping them there as much as they can.
Did that answer your question on freedom of speech?
I think in a medical context, it doesn't look special. Is there a wider issue? You talk about this across the country. What's the reception that you get, and what's the kind of the negative feedback that you get?
I think the negative feedback comes from the lobbyists who protest us and just call us transphobes, homophobes, and a hate group. So the tactics are to discredit us and to say we're only motivated by this nasty Christian condemnation for LGBT people. And what I hope to show is that compassion for LGBT people ought to cause us to question this. I actually think LGBT people deserve as much right to have children and as much right to good mental outcomes. I don't want them to be suicidal. And if we want all of those things for LGBT people as much as we want them for anyone else, then we this is not the way to go about getting the best results for them. So this is... it's a very strange political mindset. It's really hard to understand. I really had to sort of, you know, stand on my head and crick my neck and try and work out how they saw all of these dots lining up. And it's a worldview that has internal consistency. It's an ideology, but it sort of dissolves on contact with the real world. So, but the people that are in this bubble are genuine believers. They're, you know, almost fanatical about it. And the response to somebody that challenges that is emotive and quite hostile.
Thank you. Somebody else? Kim, over here. Thanks.
You were talking this morning, Dr. Taylor, about things like Tumblr and, you know, some of the websites and things. There's a lot of information out there aimed at teenagers in particular. What is there on the other side of the coin aimed at the same age group? Is there anything?
There's the ACL website.
Which is great, but it's aimed more at adults. And
no, that's right. No, it's a very good point. And I have had parents contact me and say that they want this information presented in a way that they can tell their kids about it and so that their kids can tell their friends about it as well. So it is something that we'll be working on.
So it's obviously a lot of information for someone like myself to take in.
Yeah.
I'm 20-something, I don't have kids,
mm-hmm.
I'm not a parent or anything like that, but what's something that someone like myself can do about this?
Well, a couple of things. You can, first of all, get informed, which is, you've made a good start at just now. There's The ALP party needs to be made to step back from this as their party platform before we get to the next election, because if they are elected to government, then they'll be enacting laws of the sort, according to the platform that we had up there. So at the moment, even their own members aren't aware of it, and they're certainly not aware that the general population is aware of it or would criticise it, so we need to let them know that that's not going to be a popular thing, so try and raise awareness of that. There's a petition on the ACL website that you can sign and get your friends to sign. You can share that on social media. You can also let the health regulator know that you disapprove of doctors losing their freedom of speech, which is effectively what this is. Without being dramatic, I'm an historian, and it makes me quite worried to see that this is the beginning of a totalitarian regime setting up here, and it's too late when it's here. When I was a small girl, I remember looking at a picture of a Nazi rally. The first person that mentions the Nazi loses the argument. But it's really just to show that there were 5,000 people in the audience and they all had their arms raised. And I remember asking my father and saying, wasn't there just one that disagreed? And it's too late to disagree when you're there. And now I get that, because people are so... And so what happens at this point is that we're being intimidated into silence. And you have to be, even now, you have to be very brave to put your head above the parapet. And I joined ACL, I was a mum in the bush with four kids, joined ACL, read about the Safe Schools program, wrote a report, was presenting what was perfectly solid academic research in public, and it was protested very nastily. And I thought, wow, what kind of a world have I walked into? Is this Australia? This is, I grew up in the 80s when, you could make, before the days of PC, and PC has helped just shut down debate and make it unacceptable to have certain views, and that is the beginning of silencing. So we need to push back on that. So even just being un-PC helps.
Thanks, Cam. Matt?
Thank you, Dr. Taylor, for your message this evening and this morning. I appreciate it. I'm wondering if you're aware of kind of the online work of Dr. Jordan Peterson, and if you've got any comments about some of his ideas and whether they may be helpful or not in this particular context.
Very happy to give Dr. Jordan Peterson a plug. He's, I think, one of the most interesting public intellectuals of our time. Whether you agree with him or not, I definitely recommend listening to him, because he's been a bit of oxygen for our side of the debate, I think, because so many people are intimidated and forced to back down in the face of hostility and aggression, and he's very solid and he's got a very good mind and he's spent a long time developing it. So I really recommend listening to his views, because they're well supported, and he has some fascinating ideas. And apart from anything else, he believes that men and women are different. And one of the things that frustrates me in all of this is that we're talking about the really boring questions. Are men and women different, really? This is such a kindergarten, nursery sort of question. The thing that's more interesting to me is, yes, men and women are different, and I think that, Genesis tells us that this was by design. It's not an accident that he made them male and female. But what does that mean, and how do we do that? And there's something about the complementarity of men and women that, that the path to happiness and human flourishing lies in that direction. So I agree with a lot of the things that would say we need to break down stereotypes. So just to backtrack, some of this transgender stuff came up. A few years ago, there was a family in Canada, I think, who said, we've had this little baby and we're not going to tell anyone whether it's a boy or a girl. We know whether it's a boy or a girl. We're just not going to tell anyone, because we want this child to be free of stereotypes. And this is almost where the beginning of this Genesis. We don't want this child... life opportunities to be squashed into this bunch of stereotypes of whether you're a boy or a girl. And I agree with that, actually. I think that we shouldn't be saying girls wear pink fairy dresses and boys play with trucks. And you know, when I was growing up, the whole aim was to say girls can do whatever they want and boys can do whatever they want. You can wear a pink fairy dress. You're a boy who likes to wear pink fairy dresses. Fantastic. That's not a problem. And I think most people would go along with that. What is a problem now in terms of the transgender movement is that if you're a boy who likes to wear a pink fairy dress, well, that might mean that you're really a girl. We need to affirm. And so actually that stereotype becomes the what it means to be a woman is that stereotype. And that's a problem. It's actually going the other way to where we were going a generation ago. It's counterintuitive.
What happened with the Canada family?
Oh, they went on holidays. Sometimes, I think eventually they let it out that it was a boy, but yeah. Yeah. And he's a perfectly normal boy, you know.
He's normal.
Slightly kooky family, but you know.
Another question? Gabby?
Hi there. I was just wondering, in regards to those of us who work with kids and with young people, obviously, we don't want to be enforcing and encouraging stereotypes or limiting the giftings and abilities of young people, but how, in your opinion, what's the best way that we can encourage them to seek what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman in God's eyes?
That's a very good question. I think, I personally think that boys and girls have different challenges growing up, that there is a job for boys that doesn't affect girls in the same way, that the transition from being a girl to a woman looks different to the transition from being a boy to a man. The problem, and I could go into that if you want, and I can talk about, you know, quests and chivalric you know, knights in shining armour and how I think it all sort of fits together. But one of the things that I think is where we run into trouble is where we try to define those things too narrowly. And we try to say, you know, a godly woman is someone who wears an A-line skirt and bakes really good shortbread and doesn't have, you know, rebellious opinions. And I think at that point we've run into trouble. I've come across church cultures like that before. And then on the other hand, I've come across, you know, feminist lesbians who have told me, oh, well, you're a Christian, so you've lost all capacity for independent thought because you've been indoctrinated by patriarchy from a child. And I find both equally oppressive. So I just think God will show you what it means to be you in God, and I'm not sure that we need to necessarily put that in a box that looks the same for all women and all men. I think that's where we start running into trouble. I think men and women are different. I think we have a lot more in common than we have that are separate. One of the things that I think is interesting about Jordan Peterson is that he uses psychometric profiling internationally to show that typical standards of men and women have profiles that are different, typically. So his example is, if you get a group of 10 people and you say the most aggressive person in that group is a man, then 6 times out of 10 you'll be right. But if you have a group of 100 people and you say the most aggressive person in that group is a man, you'll be right 100% of the time. So it's in large groups, in population-level groups, that stereotypes become cemented and they become obvious. Now, we celebrate them because we think, well, you know, the gossipy person's always a woman, isn't it? And the aggressive person's always a man, and we've noticed those things. But, in fact, it's not a really helpful way of understanding what a typical woman or what a typical man is. And I think there's a lot of overlap. You know, sometimes people, it's a bit like men are taller than women, but that doesn't mean that every man is going to be taller than every woman. You know, so it's on a, the stereotypes are there for a reason. I don't think it's necessarily helpful in terms of individual behaviours or individual journeys. There was just one thing that you said, Pastor Graham, before. Have I answered that question? Sorry, is that...
How we translate that into youth, whether it be working with kids or teaching or youth ministry.
So, Gabby, are you saying in a secular workplace, how you are how you are able to affirm male, female, and
yeah,
do it in
without it being stereotypical.
Okay.
Does it need to be affirmed? I don't think I ever needed anyone to tell me this is what it's like to be a woman. I think people show them, but you get shown by example, don't you? You find women that you admire and you would naturally look to them as role models. So it's probably showing rather than telling. But one thing that you asked earlier, Pastor Graham, that I just wanted to come back to, which was the effects of puberty. One of the things that is damaging about blocking puberty is that puberty is the very process that normally will orient a child to their natal sex. So by blocking it, we're actually stopping the very thing that will help them. Now, sometimes children that come out on the other side of that find that they have same-sex attraction. But and in fact, there are a lot of homosexual men. Rupert Everett, if anyone knows the British actor, says that he wanted to be a woman until he was 15. And if he'd been through the school system now, he'd be on puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, and he's really glad that he isn't, because from the age of 15, he was very happy being a man. So we're stopping the very process that will most likely help people get through this.
Somebody else?
Would you say then that for us as Christians to work in society, that perhaps to influence politics so that we're able to help prevent what you're saying, safe schools, all those sorts of things, that really we've got to get active and promote freedom of speech, freedom of religion?
Yes, that's a brilliant idea. It's exactly what we need to do. It's because typically people that have small children and have families and value those sorts of things invest their energies in those sorts of things. When you've got small children, there's not a lot of energy left for anything else. We really do need good people with solid values to get involved in the political process, because if we don't do that, we're leaving it to the bad guys. And they've been having a field day with that. In Victoria, you've got a really great example of the retaking of the Liberal Party. But I encourage you to join whatever political party you choose, but to definitely get involved, because Christians will have an influence. And even if it's joining the party and influencing pre-selection, that's huge. Just getting the right people with our values in government is so important.
I'm aware this isn't like an English or a literature class, but just the other week I read George Orwell's 1984, and I can't help but like see like a small link between possibly the gender fluidity movement and like Ingsoc's use of like doublethink and almost cognitive dissonance. It seems like, well, the fact that someone can have a contradictory belief of being a boy and a girl, and then like later choosing, I just wondering if you have an opinion about that.
Yes.
Assuming you've read the book, yeah.
No, you're spot on. So George Orwell's quite an interesting character, because he was a convinced communist for a while, went off to the Spanish Peninsula to hang out with Trotsky, I understand, and got there and realised that, whoa, this was really terrible, and no way was he a communist. So he came back and blew the whistle on it all and had a lot of trouble getting his writings published towards the end of the Second World War. But because he had that experience and that close-up understanding of it, that's why he's just such a brilliant man for exposing it and characterising it. And his essays are wonderful. And I was reading an essay of his just the other day, and he's talking about how people use words to you can respectabilize anything as long as you use the right words. You can make murder sound reasonable, and you know there's all. And he's absolutely right. And you read it and you think this man is a prophet. But in fact, all he's doing is commenting on a very leftist Marxist ideology that he saw in the communists. And in fact, we have that in cultural Marxism now, which is why it's the same creature. So Jordan Peterson recommended, he told me personally, he's speaking to me, and he said, you've got to read Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago. So I did. And I'm halfway through it. It's depressing reading. But oh my goodness, we should be getting kids to read 1984 and The Gulag Archipelago in schools, and then we wouldn't have any of this nonsense, because they would recognise ideology coming in and saying you must think this and you can't think that. And yeah, it's very controlling totalitarian behaviour. What's very interesting is that it sounds very reasonable because it's compassionate, isn't it? It's love, it's tolerance. It's all of these things that are actually Christian virtues. It's equality. Well, we believe in equality, but we believe in equality because we have an objective standard that comes from God that says God values everyone individually and therefore everyone is precious and lovely and special. If you take God out of it, then you have no basis for human equality anymore. And in fact, Peter Singer, the atheist, would say that there is no basis for valuing human life without God. You don't have, if you have compassion and it's divorced from God's standards of compassion, then suddenly it's your compassion and you can do whatever you like with it. And I was told just this week that the most radical anti-cruelty to animal laws ever enacted anywhere in history were enacted by Hitler. So you could go to jail for docking a horse's tail because that's cruel. Gassing 1.5 million people over here? Well, that's reasonable, and we can you know, smooth that over with some reasonable words. So once you divorce these concepts, which are actually Christian concepts, from God, then you can manipulate them in all sorts of ways, and you actually see them becoming monstrous. In 1984 is a really good example of that.
Jacob?
You're getting all sorts of things today. We've wandered off transgenderism. I can tell you about... what else would we like to talk about?
Following on what he said, what I see lying in the centre of the issue, as many of you might agree, is a lack of the love of God. So I guess what are your recommendations in engaging this debate in a spiritual level with the people who might not share the common ground with us? Perhaps Graham, then you can chip in.
Yeah, okay, so there's two groups of people. Some are the activists, and you're not really going to get through to them. They're not willing to be persuaded. Pray for them. I think that's probably the only thing we can do. And try not to listen too much to their nonsense and have your mind bent by it. Now, the people that you're probably talking about are their victims, who are the LGBT, especially youth, who have been lured onto this sticky flypaper of a queer identity. Now, I do think there's actually a very nasty sexual agenda behind this. If you looked at the photos that I had up of the 8-year-old drag queen and the sorts of people that he's getting involved with now, well, he's part of the drag scene. There's not very much firewall between that kid and some pretty sexualized behavior anymore, and there's no way of seeing what's appropriate and what isn't, because he's a drag queen, isn't he? And it's all a bit of fun and it's all a bit of theater, but actually those men are quite badly behaved. So how do we minister to people? I asked Walt that question. Do you use the right pronouns? Do you use their, you know, preferred name? Do you go along with the fantasy? What do you do? And he said, well, it depends what sort of a relationship you want to have with them afterwards. So when he was Laura, he had a truck driver friend, and he explained to his truck driver friend, I want to be called Laura from now on. You need to call me Laura. And his truck driver friend said, I'm not going to call you Laura. I'm going to call you Wacko. So he just called him Wacko, and and Walt was happy because that was his name. So they had I think Walt's a bit of an unusual character, mind you, but a fellow, clearly a man in a dress, but everyone called him Rachel. There was a bit of confusion over whether Rachel should use the women's bathrooms or not, and eventually the pastor just said, use my bathroom, it's over here. Now, the pastor always refused to call Rachel Rachel, always called him Lawrence. But everyone else called Rachel Rachel and loved Rachel and hugged Rachel. And after a couple of years, Rachel grew a moustache and said, call me Lawrence. And there was a big party while they threw out his enormous collection of shoes. But so in those circumstances, I think what was more important was that Rachel was included and loved better, until Lawrence knew that he was loved for who he was, he didn't have to be somebody different to be loved. So I think as long as the person knows that you love them, to some extent the name's irrelevant and immaterial, but it's about the relationship. That's what's more important. So ministering to somebody and just loving them better. Because quite often there's a dissociative disorder here. They think it's not okay to be them. And being a mother and adult convert to Christianity, I'm convinced that there's some really basic fundamental human needs that are not being met in the case of transgender people, and that is to be known for who you are, warts and all. We know you're not pretty, and we love you anyway. And that we need those two things from God. and from other Christians. So the knowing who you are doesn't mean you're Rachel or Lawrence or any of these, you know, or Wacko, any of these things. It's who you really are inside, the you that God really loves. That's what's really important. Wow, I don't envy you. I hear from beleaguered people working in the health service in Victoria. And it's difficult because there's nowhere else to work, right? You know, you're a health practitioner, you're going to work in public health. In your circumstances, I'm not sure what you can do other than be equipped to debate where people will debate with you. So my friend who went along to this gender workshop, well, gender's not as simple as you think. So what she was saying was, you know, I told her that, you know, if you want to reorient your patients to their natal sex, well, that makes you a transphobe. And she was going, oh, don't be silly. That's ridiculous. And I said, do you still want to call your son a boy and your daughters girls? And she went, yeah, of course. And I said, well, no, that makes you a bigot because you're saying that that's better or that you're assuming that that is actually their gender. Did you know that, you know, according to... So just trying to get her to understand their point of view, how they would look at her, that it's not reasonable. These people are not... Most people look at this and go, oh, okay, that seems reasonable because I think they mean the same things by compassion and, you know, and affirmation and inclusion. I think they mean the same things. Instead, they're using Orwellian doublespeak. These words mean different things. Until you can get them to understand that you're dealing with unreasonable people. So this friend of mine didn't believe me. Oh, no, you're just being silly. It can't be like that. That would never happen. I had it from the Year 12 students. This, no, don't be silly. The world's a reasonable place. Unreasonable people will never take over. And so all I was doing was putting this to my friend. So in the case of the workshop, because she'd been reading John Whitehall's articles and because she had me in her ear, she said to the presenter, look, I understand what you're saying and we want to make these vulnerable people feel comfortable, but I still want to be able to tell my son that he's a boy and my daughters that they're girls. And the presenter backed off and said, look, children's completely another, it's a really sensitive subject and I don't really want to go there. But she said the temperature in the room dropped, like everybody was, and she was thinking, but it's a reasonable thing and I just said it out loud. What's that? But from that moment, just because of the hostility that she felt, she thought, Elizabeth's right. Oh my goodness, there's something unreasonable going on here. So I think my tactic is not to meet this head on. My tactic is to out-compassion them. Because we care about those kids and they don't. And I think the more that we can show that they are not compassionate, that they are actually just pursuing a political agenda, that these children are being used as a human shield. But in your circumstances, that will look different on a daily basis and it will require a lot of wisdom, I think, to know what conversations to have and which conversations not to have. I feel for you, though. I pray for you. There's a question over there. Oh.
Go, Corey.
Me?
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Just with the suicide rate of transgenders being at about 50%, you were saying earlier, why isn't it classed as a mental illness? And why isn't that something that people are looking at? Why is it not talked about?
Because the people that talk about it are hateful bigots and homophobes and they're not inclusive. So the way they see it is that the reason these people are unhappy is because we have binary concepts of gender. We are responsible for making them feel that they are excluded, and that alone is causing this mental health. So, in fact, it's not because there are other issues here. It's actually just because we're horrible. We are now responsible for all of those suicides. And this is the logic that's used to say that transphobia is actually just transphobic misinformation, like the fact that it might be a mental problem, well, that is a form of violence. And that's why misgendering, in New York, you can be fined up to $250,000 for willful and deliberate misgendering. It's against the law in Canada. There's the pronoun law, C-16, and a law in California envisages prison sentences for people who misgender, because that is responsible for the suicides. So it's kooky thinking. I mean, it's looking completely... Although, if you look at it from another way, statistically, more LGBT kids come from broken homes. It's not always the case, of course. Some of them come from perfectly lovely families. You can't work out what's gone on. But in just as a statistical average, a lot more of them come from broken homes, abusive households, drug and alcohol dependence, financial, you know, food insecurity, all of those things. So why would it be that more transgender kids, if there's, you know, nothing wrong with transgenderism, it could be anywhere in the population, why this statistical variation? Why is it that transgender identity very often coincides with autism, depression, dissociative disorders, anxiety, behavioural disruptive disorders? It's hardly ever just on its own. So all of this, all of the signs are, this is a mental disorder. This is why Paul McHugh shut it down in the 1970s. In fact, there was another endocrinologist, who's a hormone therapist, who was working with John Money, called Charles Ehlenfeld. So endocrinology, it's a specialism. You've got to study quite a long time to be an endocrinologist. And he gave up being an endocrinologist and retrained as a psychologist because he wanted to help these people. And he realised that Paul McHugh was right and that hormones wasn't helping and that this was a mental disorder. So it's not new information. It's just we're being told, believe this, don't believe that, and there's a carrot and a stick associated with it. So if you didn't have the independent information, you would just kind of follow along and think, look, it comes wrapped up in the International Journal of Transgender Medicine. It must be right. The transgender movement's very well funded by cisgender heteronormative white guys in America. One philanthropic family's donated $400 million to the transgender movement internationally, and that's not what, you know, that's in addition to George Soros. So it's a political movement that aims at the destruction of the family, and this, there wouldn't be a transgender movement without that funding.
Before we close, sorry, do you want to ask a question?
I just wanted to ask about the Safe Schools program. I'm just interested to know how well rolled out it is in public schools. So we know it's there, but is it at the discretion of the principal or teachers? Does it have to be taught? Is it taught in every single class and every single year level that where it's appropriate?
Right, okay, yeah. Anyway. No, I see what you're asking. The Safe Schools program has morphed. So the curriculum that I showed you was part of it. It wasn't all of it. But it was the reason it's so useful to us is that it was an overreach because they were saying, oh, it's nothing to do with queer theory. No, it's all fine. And we could say, well, look, here's your curriculum. This is what you say. So they did say, oh, whoops, we probably shouldn't have written it down because before that it was going under the wire. So we call it Safe Schools, but in fact the same ideology will take all sorts of different forms. And the Safe Schools program itself, just to answer one part of that question, is that the current government says it wants it to be compulsory for all public schools. It's not necessarily going to be taught in the classrooms, though, with that curricula. But it does mean that the school policies need to conform with queer normativity. So we support, we affirm, we train teachers in how to observe, spot the signs of a queer identity in a child and how to encourage and affirm that. Now, I've been talking to some parents who are on the other side of this, and it's just devastating for them. One family, her daughter identified as bisexual, and they didn't find out till some time later that she had been sexually abused. But they didn't know that. And she's saying, I'm sure that prepared her for believing that there was something up with her sexuality. Well, yeah, probably. But none of that's looked into. So, but meanwhile, the parents are disempowered because, no, we know that your daughter's bisexual and hands off, you abusive parent, you've got to come this way and we know what's best and you're on the railroad. So it in terms of policy, it's dangerous. But it's not necessarily being taught in the same way in the classroom to every school. So if you're in the public system, it will really depend, actually anywhere you are, it will really depend a lot on teachers and the leadership of the school and how tolerant they are. So if you've got a really activist teacher, there's no one that's really going to supervise what they're saying in the classroom, and how do you really tell? Just be very aware of what your children are saying coming home. So that it will vary, and this is what's dangerous about it now, because it's acceptable, it's okay to be teaching this stuff. And the teachers' unions in all of the states are really, really activist. So even if the Department of Education says no, you know, there's no way of stopping really determined teachers slipping things in. The best prevention is the best defence, I think, in this, and that is making sure that your kids are rock solid from, you know, that they have a very stable childhood, because typically the kids who, I mean, and this is again just statistically, a lot of them come from single parent backgrounds. They're not loved. They're not, at least they're not secure. They are loved, but they're not as secure as they otherwise would be. They've got trauma in their background. There's something like that. So love them, pray for them, and maintain really good communication with them, I think, through adolescence. So all of the things that you would be doing anyway, they just become extra important, but probably also being really hyper-vigilant about the sorts of messages that they'll be getting from the media, from the contemporary culture that's aimed and really directly targeting these kids. Church youth groups, fantastic, yeah. Watching out for their friends, and if you have any problems, ring HRLA, the Human Rights Law Alliance, which is an offshoot of ACL. So we take up quite a lot of things on behalf of parents. If you have any trouble and you want some legal advice, then that's a good way to get it.
Hey, man, let's thank Dr. Elizabeth Taylor for her help. Thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you very much for sharing the way you have
and making yourself vulnerable and being open with us. We really do appreciate it. Let's pray. Father, we just thank you for today. We thank you that, Lord God, in the midst of stuff that we know is not of you, that, Lord God, that we can share, that we can support each other. And, Father, I know that, again, as we pray and as we continue to allow your Spirit to lead us, you will guide us, you will give us wisdom, you will give us understanding. Your word says in James, Lord, if any lack wisdom, let him ask and it will be given liberally. Lord, we need your wisdom in how to act as parents, how to act as leaders, and how to act as Christians in this world that we live. And so we just thank you for your guidance and for your love. Amen.